Well, it's difficult to describe a more extreme situation than the one that these three guys with the funny names found themselves in. Just to set the scene for you, we're not going to look back in Daniel chapter 1, but I've said already we're about 500 or 600 years before Jesus was born. And just so you know, in case you don't already, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and their great friend Daniel, after whom this book is named and who seems to have written it, were taken by force from their homeland, and their homeland was the promised land, Israel. They were taken by force by an invading army of the empire of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar in particular. They were selected under duress for a formal education for the service of this foreign invading king. And once they'd been through that education, they were taken and selected for high office, chosen by him for high office. And now faced with a challenge, their challenge is not just to their political and physical freedom, though that is true. The challenge is finally to their faith. Up until this point, they've been allowed to worship the God of the Bible, the God of their fathers, as they like. But now at last, the rubber has hit the road, and they're in a foreign land, and they're being forced, apparently, to worship foreign gods. What does it feel like to be a long way from home, a long way from you, from where you belong? Can I say that at first glance, this passage in Daniel 3 looks about as unrelated to 21st century Chippenham as could possibly be. What on earth has this got to do with us, let alone how on earth does it point to Jesus? But I hope this morning that by the end of looking through this account together, we will see both a close connection and a remarkable truth. Here in Daniel 3, for Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, it had apparently become even more tough. You see, because they refused to do what everyone else was doing, and indeed what the king had told them to do, they were refusing to bow down to this idol that the king of Babylon had set up on the plain of Dura. I don't know what it looked like. Probably it looked something like that. And just see who was there. All the other provincial officials. The Queen has been to Salisbury this week. And Rob Perks, one of our folk, was there to meet her. I don't actually think you got to speak to her, did you? Which is a great shame. But you got this idea, haven't you, that all the provincial officials, people who work for the council, people who work for others, had come from all over the place to gather, not in fact in Salisbury, but on this place, the plain of Dura. And thankfully, the Queen knows and loves the Lord Jesus, she says, and so she wouldn't have asked anybody to do this. But this king had gathered people from all the officials from all of his huge empire, right the way across the different nations. He gathered them all onto this plain, and as soon as they heard any music, down they went to worship the god that the king had made. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were living in exile from their own land. Just imagine what it would have been like. Thousands of people, all the provincial officials, the governors, the judges, the civil servants, all bowing down when the music played, and these three guys stay standing. If you really want to know what peer pressure is about, to conform to what everybody else is doing, then this roundabout bite takes the biscuit, doesn't it? Everybody else has been drawn. Maybe it's taken them months to travel from the far reaches of the Babylonian Empire to this point where they bow down to this idol. And verse 6 of our passage says all we need to know about those who disobey. Whoever, it says, does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are those always, of course, who are happy to grasp on those who don't conform. And whether it's because they don't like them, because they're jealous of their position and authority, or maybe it's because they feel threatened by them, some of the astrologers, those who worship things in the stars, spot these three guys standing, and they decide to tell the king. What better way to get rid of any religious opposition than to make sure that the three guys who are lost in the crowd, albeit that they're the only ones still standing, are pointed out so everyone else can see. But before we look at what happened, it's important to ask why these three guys took their stand, literally, that they stood as they did. In verse 12, we read that they're called Jews. And that well describes what they are. We've got to get an understanding of why they won't bow down, you see, so that we can understand why they had such confidence. Go back in your mind's eye for a moment, right to the beginning. Right at the beginning of the Bible, here is Genesis chapters 1 and 2 and 3. And God made the world, and he made human beings to be in the world. And Adam and Eve, our first parents, were in this beautiful Garden of Eden, and they could do anything they like except one thing, and it's the one thing they chose to do. And in so doing, they rebelled against God, and their relationship with God was broken. But in the midst of the condemnation for their rebellion, God sent the promise of a rescue. And so as you go through the Bible, you have actually not a list of rules and regulations, but a rescue plan from God being spelled out so everyone can see. And part of that rescue plan involved a family, the family of Abraham. And at that point, Judaism and the Jewish nation was born. And Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob led his family into Egypt, and they were in Egypt for 400 years. And this may, whether or not you're familiar with the Bible, it may start to stir your memory where you think about Moses leading the people out of slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land through the Red Sea. And before they got to the Promised Land, God gave them the terms of what it means to know him, the terms of their relationship with him. He gave them the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments explain to the people of God how they are to treat the God who has rescued them. Of course, they couldn't keep those Ten Commandments, which were designed in part to make them rely on God's faithfulness in their failure. Yet as so many of them couldn't even be bothered to try to honor him in the Promised Land when they arrived, so some of them continued to want to love and trust and honor him and keep the terms of that relationship. And when finally, because of their sheer disobedience, he sends the Babylonian Empire into the Promised Land to take them into exile, so still there are those who want to rely on God and honor God and love God above all, even though they can't keep up with it. And Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego are trying to honor God and rely on him to honor them. Why wouldn't they bow down when everybody else is around? Answer: because one of the Ten Commandments told them not to. Part of their relationship with God meant that they would honor him above all. Let me just read to you, or it'll come up on here, what those Ten Commandments are. Let me read to you the Ten Commandments. It says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." Here we go. "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew that as far as they were concerned, there's one God, and him alone are they to honor. They're not going to bow down to an idol or to anything else, because there's only one God, and him they are to honor. Of course, the furious king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, had brought them before him and asked him the one question that got to the nub of the problem. Look at verse 15 in our passage. "Now you three, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I've made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing fire." Here's the question. "Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" It's a good question, isn't it? What God will be able to rescue you from the hand of the greatest superpower that has lived up until that point? Nebuchadnezzar had this idea that gods were all local. Gods were things that could be made. Gods were things that were made up by human beings in their head and fashioned into idols. And he just happened to have had this idea, with all his riches and wealth and power, that he could make one bigger than anybody else's that everybody had to fall down before. By making an idol that big, he was declaring that my God is bigger than all of yours. By pulling people from the Hindu Kush, by pulling people from Egypt, by pulling people from Syria and from the rest of Iraq and all the different parts of his empire, and making the provincial officials bow down, they were acknowledging that Nebuchadnezzar's God was bigger than theirs, bolder than theirs. After all, he blasted their armies out the way. Why could it not be possible that their gods were not worth worrying about? what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? He's given me your land. Surely you can't believe he'll stand up to me. This is the new thing, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is what it's to be worshipped, the God that I have made. Everything else is old hat. I want everyone to do things my way. And just stop and think about that for a minute. Does that sound familiar? Everybody's got to do things my way. Think about the world in which we live, where what God you worship or not, to a very large extent in most of the world, sets the terms under which you're accepted. Maybe it's the enforced Islamization for much of the Arab world. Maybe it's that. And if you don't do that 3 times a day, you're in big trouble. Or maybe it's the atheism of the communist world, where people who believe in anything other than the state and worship anything other than the state find themselves in big trouble. Or maybe it's just the increasingly aggressive secularization of the Western world, where to believe in anything other than the here and now makes you a crackpot and a nut, which is what many people will say, though it's a minority position, can I say, in most of the world. Cultures have their own way and like to have their own way, and almost always it's away from the God of the Bible. Don't bother with him. You don't need to think about him. A God is something that you make up in your head. God is something that you set your own terms about knowing. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew that they couldn't because God had set the terms for them. Don't bother with him. The only God you need to worry about is this one, or else Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And to anybody else that wants to worship the God of the Bible for all of history. I think, do you notice their reply? I think it's perhaps one of the most courageous replies in the whole of the Bible. Because it makes clear that their priority is God, whatever the cost. Look at verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. What are they saying? They're saying, we will worship the Lord no matter what it costs us, be it our jobs, be it our reputations, or be it our lives. Because the God we serve is not a God of our own making. Because the God we love is not a God of our imagination. He's not a God who's a long way. He's not a provincial God who doesn't have any rule here. He's not a God who loses control when everything seems to go wrong. We know the terms of the God who loves us, and we will worship him no matter what. Now, what happened next we've all read, but it bears more careful consideration because there's so much here that will teach us about how God works. I've said already that this is hero stuff. But you know, the heroes here are not Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. The hero here, as always in the Bible, is God. God's people may be brave and may have great faith, but they're never heroes. God is always the hero. And as they face the fierce anger of Nebuchadnezzar, look what God does. I guess it's not surprising that Nebuchadnezzar couldn't believe their insolence. How could these three exiles disobey him? How could they be so cheeky? How could they possibly believe that their God is greater than his God? After all, his God is 90 feet high and made of gold and has conquered everything else. So far, apparently, he's been giving them the benefit of the doubt, giving them a chance, making sure they understand what they must do. But they will not obey. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed, and he ordered the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. I wonder if you can see it in the background of this picture. No, it's the previous one. Gone too far. Hang on. I wonder if you can see it in the background of this picture.
I mean, this is just an artist's impression of what was there. But a Babylonian furnace is understood to be something like that shape, but with steps going up the side. So here it is, this great upside-down pot thing, heated presumably so you can smelt metal in the very top where the heat is the greatest. But in this particular case, they stoked it up 7 times hotter than usual, so that as they went up the side, even the soldiers themselves were killed putting the men in. That's how evil Nebuchadnezzar was, and he didn't care who was hurt. They were taken up, we're told, verse 22. They fell in, verse 23. So furious is he, so insolent are they, that he wants to be sure that they can't possibly survive the punishment. You can see him standing there, can't you? Looking at all these other provincial officials stood around, ready for this example to be set. And they've all bowed down, and these three guys haven't. Look at what happens to them, says Nebuchadnezzar. Look at the example they're going to be. Look what happens to people who want to serve the God of the Bible. Well, just look what happens. He's making an example of them. He's making sure his orders are obeyed. And it does seem that he expected them to try and escape. Verse 20, he commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, still wearing their robes, their trousers, their turbans, their clothes, were bound and thrown in, and the soldiers were killed. How can it possibly be that when faced with odds like that, people who know and love the living God stand the test? You know, when the communists took over China in the 1930s, they worked through China, both destroying churches and harassing missionaries, killing off where they possibly could those who wanted to worship anything but their system. In one university town where Gladys Aylward, the famous missionary from London, had been working, they forced each of the 500 students in that university, small university, to complete a questionnaire about themselves and their families and their allegiance. And the last question on that questionnaire was crucial. What political party do you support? Where is your allegiance, is what they were asking. If you are for the communist government, and thus an atheist, put a circle. But if you are against, put a cross. The 200 Christian students put a cross. And for 3 months, they had constant harassment and difficulty from the 300 communist students, and they were eventually marched to the town square. The first student was a girl of about 17 years of age, and from a wealthy family. And having endured the harassment and aggravation of the government and the other students for 3 months, she was pulled forward and questioned in front of everyone. "Who do you support now?" said the official in front of the assembled crowd. The girl answered before the whole town, "Sir, 3 months ago I thought Jesus Christ was real, and I thought that the Bible was true. But now, after 3 months of your hatred, I know that Jesus Christ is real, and I know that the Bible is true." White with rage, the official gave the order, and a soldier forced her to her knees and beheaded her. And then they called up the next student of the 200, and he said the same, with the same result. All 200 students faced the same result. You see, the world hates God's people when they won't give in. And the world hates people who are so convinced of their Lord and his word that they will not relent. Nebuchadnezzar has turned the heat up. Don't be surprised, I suppose we should say, if you're a Christian this morning, if the heat is turned up when you want to trust in the God of this ancient text, who has changed so much of the world and by which we date our years. For Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, it meant being thrown, fully clothed and bound in front of the huge crowd into a furnace so hot that even their guards were killed. Can you imagine how frightened they must have been? Imagine their concern for their families. What's going to happen next? But actually what happened next is so amazing that Nebuchadnezzar and his mood changed, because after that he could see that they had divine company. Now the next slide can come up. I don't know whether it looked like this or not, but it was something like this. Verse 24, let's read it, and then our own imaginations can fill in the gaps. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement, and he asked his advisers, "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth..." Well, he's grappling for words, isn't he? "The fourth looks like a son of the gods." See, as Nebuchadnezzar looked through the door, he could not see three burning bodies, but four men walking around, freely, unbound, unharmed, presumably having a conversation, wondering what the fuss is about. But there are not three, there's four. And remember, this fire is seven times hotter than usual. The side of the furnace, they couldn't get near. But they can see. And one is shining. The fourth person is a divine being. It's a divine being who keeps on appearing in various places. And he's not described as an angel. He's described as the angel. God himself is there with his people. Here walking in the flames with Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego is God. Do you see that? All around them is fierce, but he is right there with them in the midst of it. 100 years before, the prophet Isaiah had something important to say to God's people in preparation for the events of this terrible exile. Just turn with me, will you, for a moment to Isaiah and chapter 43. Page 511. 120 years or so before God's people were taken into exile, the prophet Isaiah was sent to get them ready, to bring a message of hope in the midst of despair. And he said to them these words from God. Fear not, verse 1. Let me read from chapter 43, verse 1. But now this is what the Lord says. He who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name, and you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. Do you know, there are many points that we could raise from that passage. But perhaps the one I want us to see is this. God did not save them from the fire. He saved them in the fire. How does this point to Jesus? Because he's right there. Yes, it's a marked illustration for us that our minds can grasp. And they could see him, and so apparently could everybody else. But can you see it? If God had saved them from the fire, they would never have had the privilege of walking with God through the flames. And it was a privilege that neither they nor anyone else who was watching would forget. Some 15 years ago, my sister was diagnosed with cancer. And while the cancer was beaten, the treatment killed her. But in the course of the treatment, she had to have an MRI scan. Now, you may have had an MRI. And if you haven't had an MRI, let me tell you, they're about the safest scans that you can possibly have. But they're a bit scary. And they're scary because they put you inside the tube that is fractionally bigger than your body. And they're terribly claustrophobic. And they make awful noises. So if you're given the option, if you have to have one of these, relax. They're about as safe as they can be, really. But if they give you the option of a sedative, say yes, okay? She didn't. And in the middle of her scan, she made the mistake of opening her eyes. And she found herself in a terribly confined space with 20 minutes to go. And she had faith in the Lord and she cried out to him, "Lord, help me, because I'm going to panic now." And then she remembered that promise in the New Testament, "Surely I am with you always," said Jesus. And she knew that as she described it, right there in that MRI scanner, a piece that she couldn't possibly have explained, but that she described afterwards she wouldn't have missed for anything in the world. He was there, you see. Can I say, if you're a Christian today, then you know that the Lord is with you because he promises to be. How could these Chinese students, facing certain death on their confession of Jesus Christ, do that? Because he was giving them a strength from beyond themselves, that's why. How could Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego possibly be willing to go into that furnace? Well, all they had to do was bow down. I mean, come on. Answer. Because they knew that the Lord was with them and he would keep his promises. As they were thrown in, they couldn't have known that he would be walking around in the fire. Nothing like that had ever happened before. But they knew the God in whom they trusted loved them more than they understood. And so they understood enough to trust him still. How can you and I possibly face living in a broken world where actually if you want to even express confidence in God, particularly in the midst of aggravation or difficulty or sadness, the world looks at you as though you're stupid. How can you do that? The answer is because God makes and keeps promises. Not to keep us from the fire, but to guide us through it. And the result will always ultimately be the same. Psalm 46 puts it this way. "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." Look at what happens with Nebuchadnezzar, verse 26 of our passage. "Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here.' So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps and prefects and governors and royal advisers crowded round them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed, for their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. And Nebuchadnezzar, this pagan king who made his own gods and expected the world to bow down to them, said," what? He said this. "He said, 'Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than worship or serve any god except their own.'" Just see the change? An example had been made of them, but because they trusted God and stuck to him, because they relied on him when they could rely on nothing else, the answer in the end is that the answer to Nebuchadnezzar's question, "What God is able to save you from my hand?" he had found for himself. The Lord can. But not just that, Nebuchadnezzar, the pagan king, is honoring the God of the Bible. Look, he's calling him, verse 26, the Most High God. In other words, there are servants of the God who is higher than the gods of Babylon. There are servants of the God that are higher than the idol that I've set up. What a turnaround. He isn't yet a true believer. And he doesn't order the worship of the Lord, which would have been wrong anyway, But neither does he remove the statue. He does this over-the-top thing in verse 25 of threatening anybody that says anything against the Most High God. Well, chapter 4 is coming if you're interested in what happens to Nebuchadnezzar, and you can see there that his mind has changed completely. But you see, it may well be that standing for God will prove difficult, costly, even dangerous or fatal, but in the end, God will be glorified through it. And can I say that if you're a Christian, and your aim should be to trust him and honor him and love him and see what he does. But just as you ponder that point for a moment, think about the one person in history, the most godly person that there is, whose experience was a contrast to the ones we've been thinking of. Think back for a moment to the furnace and the fourth person walking around. And for Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, the fire's not harming them, and their clothes don't smell, and they step out, and everyone's amazed. What's going on? The person who was with them somehow calmed the flames. How does this point to Jesus? Well, it points to Jesus in this way. Firstly, that he's there. But secondly, one other way. When he himself faced the furnace of God's wrath on the cross, when he himself walked in darkness, when he himself hung for us, he didn't have anyone walking with him. In fact, Mark chapter 15 tells us that he cried out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was in God's plan to take the punishment for our rebellion against God, take the flames and fire of God's wrath upon himself, so that we wouldn't have to. Can I say, if you're not a Christian this morning, you may be alarmed at some of the difficulties I've mentioned that Christians face. And you may be claiming that God has no idea of the sort of agony that you're going through in life, or the difficulties you face, or the problems that will ensue. The answer to that is that he knows all about it, and even more. No one knows more about losing a loved one than God does. No one knows more about suffering than God does. No one knows more about sacrifice than God does. No one knows more about pain than God does. No one knows more about paying a price for others than God does. And he did it for you, so that you and I can know that he walks with us, has risen again from the dead, has beaten our greatest enemy, and has loved us more than we understand. He has faced worse than you and I can ever imagine, because he was forsaken so that you and I wouldn't have to be. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego went on to survive and did their work and witness for God in their time in Babylon. You and I do not live in Babylon, nor still Iraq. We live in a world that is broken, but a world in which by his grace we can know him walking with us through whatever we face, and know that he's loved us to death.